and welcome to the Big Technology Podcast, a show for cool-headed, nuanced conversations of the tech world and beyond. Joining us today is a very special guest. She's a computer scientist, the president of Harvey Mudd College, and a former Microsoft board member who's agreed to come on and speak with us about her experiences. Maria Clave, welcome to the show.
Well, my pleasure.
It's great to have you. I've been following your career for a while, and you've been involved in some really interesting moments in tech, and I can't express how grateful I am to have you here on the show, so thank you for joining us. So usually with, you know, the interviews that we do, I like to kind of, you know, we go in with like a soft takeoff, and then maybe we get to the more intense stuff, but sorry, I think we have to just start with the more intense stuff right off the bat, because I read this Business Insider article that, you know, quoted you about your time at Microsoft, and it, my eyes kind of dropped out of my head after having read some of the details in there. So for folks who are just, you know, coming into this story, you had hosted or had interviewed Satya Nadella in 2014, and the issue, and it was an event for women about women in the tech world. And this issue came up where, I mean, I'm going to let you tell the story. But I'll just start it off and then you can go from there. But this issue came up where you asked Satya a very fair question, which apparently he had the question in advance, which was if a woman wants a raise in the workplace, how do they bring it up? Very simple question. So how did, and it turned into a bit of an issue. So take us from there. How did Satya answer that, and why did he get him into trouble?
Well, the first thing is that it was the last question in the interview. It was an hour-long fireside chat at the Grace Hopper Celebration of Women in Computing. And I think one of the things was that Satya was used to interacting with me in my persona at the Microsoft board meetings. And I had learned to be fairly quiet there, just because when I spoke up, I would often get sort of trounced by Bill Gates. Or wow. Somebody else.
And what do you mean trounced, by the way?
Yelled at for asking what seemed like a straightforward question and being asked if I was trying to destroy the company.
Really?
Yeah.
Isn't the purpose, sorry, we're already going off track, but isn't the purpose of the board to sort of press management in a way that they might not be getting,
well,
you know, within the rest
I
of the
thought,
company?
But most of this would happen whenever I'd ask about a technology, diversity in the tech company.
So Bill Gates kind of wasn't hearing that.
Right. Mm-hmm. So he was not interested in that. But okay. In any case, Satya had agreed to do this. It was about, I think about 9 months into his time, or maybe 8 months into his time as CEO. And I thought very, very highly of Satya. I still do. And yeah. I was really delighted that he agreed to let me interview him. And he actually asked that the women employees at Microsoft from around the world be allowed to suggest the questions. Mm-hmm. And so he of those suggested questions, he picked the ones that he wanted to answer and gave me the list. And this was the last.
No tricks.
Yes. So this was the last one on the list. They were all good questions. But the thing about this was that I'm a pretty goofy person at Grace Hopper. I think Satya just was surprised by the way I was. Mm-hmm. And as a result, he was, I think, got a little bit more relaxed than he normally would have been. And and so when I asked this question, which was, if you wanted a pay raise, what would your advice? If a woman wanted a pay raise at Microsoft, what would your advice be? And his response was something on the order of, it's good karma just to let the system take care of it. So you shouldn't ask.
Yeah, I have the exact quote. It's not really about asking for a raise, but knowing and having faith that the system will give you the right raise, which, I mean, you push back, you know, very, you know, appropriately, because if you trusted the system, you wouldn't have to ask that question.
Yeah. And also, I mean, there's sort of two things about asking for a raise. And I will just say, as I probably said, actually, the interview, I'm not very good at asking for raises myself. I've gotten better over the years. But one thing I've learned is it's important to practice making the ask with somebody you're comfortable with so that you're not all nervous. And secondly, it's important to have your data. and have an idea of what a competitive salary would be and be able to pitch it as a win for both the company and for you. And so that's what I said. And that particular part of the interview went viral instantly. And Satya, immediately after the interview, he sent a message to every Microsoft employee apologizing for getting the answer wrong and saying that Maria had it right. And then, you know, I saw him later on in the afternoon and talked to him about it. And by the next day, what he said was he was going to go back to Microsoft and he was going to take some courses on diversity and inclusion. And he was going to make sure the rest of the senior team did as well, because if he could get that wrong, maybe others could as well. And I think he was completely right there.
Yeah, he's called it like one of the most important moments for him in Microsoft. I think obviously it sort of opened his eyes to where his blind spot might have been, which as a leader, to see your blind spot and then learn is a good quality.
And I can't tell you how many people, both inside Microsoft and outside Microsoft, told me how much they admired the fact that he admitted he got it wrong, and the fact that he took a lot of steps thereafter to really try and improve diversity and inclusion kind of things at Microsoft. And, you know, I heard for the next 3 years or so from women at Microsoft, oh my goodness, things are so much better. So
I thought it was a very big scandal for him. Early going.
I don't think scandal is the right word. Yeah. I think it's more like this was a really good learning opportunity where he displayed that as a CEO, he could learn. And I heard so many good, so many comments from so many people around the world about how impressed they were with how he handled it. So I didn't think of it as a scandal at all.
Maybe I should rephrase that a little bit. I think it was a bit of a PR snafu, because the next day, you know, I was researching before this conversation and every major network carried it as we were trying to figure out who's this Satya Nadella who's taking over the story tech company. That was one of the big first impressions that he made. And even before the networks could pronounce his name, were talking about this. But you're right. Definitely a learning moment.
Well, I did 15 news interviews the next day. I mean, and initially Microsoft had asked me not to talk to reporters, and then they decided it would be better if I did talk to reporters. And so, and we agreed on what the message would be, which was entirely what I believed, which is he made a mistake. People make mistakes. He corrected it. He's going to make sure that things are actually better in terms of women and other underrepresented groups at Microsoft in the future.
So, and that was the initial story. And I think that's largely what's been talked about up until recently. And then, again, this is this Business Insider story that just came out by Ashley Stewart, came out in May, where you talked a little bit more about what happened in the aftermath. So, you know, the timing's interesting, right? So this conversation happens in October 2014. October 2015, you announced that you're leaving the board. What happened in the year in between?
Well, the chair of the board was John Thompson. He became chair of the board when Satya became the CEO. And he told me very directly that he was very upset that I had, number one, invited Satya to do that interview, and number two, corrected him when he gave the wrong answer. And I told him that and he felt that I'd hurt the reputation of Microsoft by doing that. And I argued back that as far as I was concerned, Satya was the first CEO of Microsoft to be interviewed on the main stage at Grace Hopper. He was very happy to do it. He did a great job, except for that one answer. And that the way he'd handled it had actually helped Microsoft's research reputation enormously as a result. And that there was no reason, I completely disagreed with John, that this was something that hurt the company.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, John might have looked at it as PR crisis, but ultimately a board is there to make the company better.
Yeah.
And you would imagine this was one of those key moments that's going to make the company better.
Well, so that's what I thought, but it definitely wasn't what John thought.
Right. And so I'm curious, like, I'm curious who you think he was looking out for, you know, and when he came to you with that pushback. And then if you could share a little more about what happened after that.
Well, I think he thought he was looking out for the company. I think he just disagreed with me and with many others about the impact on Microsoft of that having happened. And, you know, essentially he came to see me the September, so a little bit less than a year afterwards, to tell me that he was going to ask me to leave the board, that he wanted to have more quote unquote conventional women on the board who weren't as outspoken.
What is that? What I mean, in his words, conventional? That's unbelievable.
Yes, conventional businesswomen. You know, he wanted to replace me with two women, which he thought would make, and one of them was a woman of color. He thought that would make me very happy. And, you know, at the time I felt I had two possibilities. One is I could object and I could have gone to the media at that point. And the other one is I could, try to find a way to work through it more smoothly. And at the time, I will say I was tremendously upset. And
Describe how it felt, because that's...
Oh, I felt completely silenced and dismissed. I mean, I just felt I had put a lot of effort into Microsoft. I really loved the company. And I just felt that I had actually helped the company by doing this interview with Satya. And I just felt really... I don't know what the dissed, I guess, dismissed, disregarded, all of those kinds of things. So it was interesting. My daughter does peace negotiations currently for the United Nations in Syria. And she talked to me about it before I actually had the meeting with John. He'd announced that he wanted to come see me in person. And had set a date, you know, maybe a week to 10 days. And I knew what he was going to say. And because there's just no way he would have come to visit me in person unless he was going to ask me to leave the board. And so I talked to my daughter about it, and she took me through this negotiation strategy, she did her law degree at Harvard and, you know, had done a lot of negotiation work. And as a result, I came up with a reason that I would want to leave the board. And because I thought that it would be more diplomatic and more professional to simply say that I was going to be asking Bill Gates for a major gift, and there would be a conflict if I were to do that while I was still on the board. And so, in fact, my meeting with John Thompson was extremely cordial. And it is true that I was hoping to ask Bill for a $20 million gift for a new computer science building we were going to build. And it sort of sounded as though Bill was leaning towards doing that. In the end, he gave us $1 million. Which was a huge disappointment. The building is now built. It's totally gorgeous. It's called the Scott McGregor Center. And it is one of the most beautiful computer science buildings I've seen in my career. But in any case, I had chosen this particular route. And, you know, I think part of what happened in the time, you know, so you might ask, well, you know, why would I actually talk about it now? And I think part of it is there were a lot of things at the time I found really quite distasteful about my experiences of being on the Microsoft board. And one of them was, you know, certainly the way that Bill treated any any question about. So the way this came up was there was at one of my early meetings, maybe my first board meeting, there was a list of 50 people on the succession chart for the CEO. At that point, the CEO was Steve Ballmer. And there were no women out of the 50.
Wait, let's just pause on that. 50 people as a possible successor to Ballmer.
Yes.
All men?
All men. And two people of color who are both Indian.
Hmm.
And I'm like, you know, how can that be right in a company like Microsoft? How could it possibly be that there are 50 people and there are no women and there are only two people of color out of 50 and they're both Indian? And that was when Bill said, are you trying to destroy the, are you trying to effing destroy the company? Except he didn't say effing. He said the real
word. He told that to you.
Yeah. At the board table. And I said, the other woman on the board, who's Dina DeBlon, when we had our first break, she came up to him. She said, Maria, it's so nice to have someone else that Bill is yelling at.
Hmm.
She said,
did he give I'll let you continue. Did he give a reason or, I mean,
no, it was just like, you idiot. Why would you think diversity in the succession chain matters? I mean, yeah. Okay. So, and there was a fair amount of that kind of thing where mm-hmm. This was my first, I'd been on startup boards before, but this is my first public company. And so, mm-hmm. of course, I got sent to a bunch of board training. So mm-hmm. the first one I went to was at the Stanford Law School, offered one. And you're told over and over again, the most important thing to do is ask questions.
Right.
And
what's the board's for?
It was just like, why would you ask questions? What? Mm-hmm. You know, why aren't you just shutting up? Because one of the things I was told was that in the early days of the board, that board meetings, they had to be held on weekends because Bill and Steve didn't want to use up valuable weekday time for this nonsense of having to meet with the board.
So they didn't have such a high opinion of what was the Bill's role at the time? Because he had left the CEO. So what was he officially doing at Microsoft?
He was chief software architect at that point.
Mm-hmm. And did he have a board role? Or
was he on the board, yes.
Okay. All right.
At that time, he was actually he was chair of the board.
Okay. So he's the board chair.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm trying to remember who was the lead independent director when I first started. I think it was somebody who left the board soon after that. And then it was Reed Hastings.
Right.
And then it moved around. But
yeah. So you said, so like you're deciding to speak up now. And the reason is?
First of all, I just turned 70 yesterday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yes. Thank you. And I just realized that it's time to talk about some of these things. Like part of it, I think, is that I have a lot of respect for Melinda Gates.
Mm-hmm.
And I think before their divorce was announced, I was in some ways reluctant to criticize Bill.
Okay.
And because it would, in some ways, the criticism could be interpreted as also criticizing Melinda. And I think Melinda has done amazing things. I'm a huge admirer. And so I think that was part of it. You know, I heard from a number of people afterwards that, I got talked about in the Valley as being very outspoken. Well, I am very outspoken. That is definitely mm-hmm. true. And I just felt it was time to actually speak up about going through an experience like that. And it was interesting because before the Business Insider article was published, I had, you know, they always check, you know, so they checked with Microsoft, they spoke to Brad Smith, they checked with Bill, the people representing Bill. Bill's comment was, he's always being a big champion of women. Look at all the things the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has done to support women. Well, yeah, they have done amazing things, but that's not because of Bill.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a conversation with Brad Smith, and I already said I have a lot of respect for Satya Nadella. I also have a lot of respect for Brad Smith. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of like, why would you do this now? And I'm sort of saying, because I think it's, it was a really bad experience from my perspective. And I think people should start to talk about these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so just to recap, so the story is, I mean, fairly unbelievable, but I guess believable given the world that we live in. But you sit down with Satya. He has the questions ahead of time. Let me know if I'm getting any of this wrong. He has the questions ahead of time. One of them is, how should women ask for raises inside a company? He says, trust the system and karma will end up bringing the raises. And he gets criticized for that because the system hasn't been traditionally good at delivering raises to women. I mean, in tech for sure, we know that to be true. He then apologizes and says this is one of the main things that have helped his leadership inside Microsoft. And then the head of the board comes for you. I mean,
yeah.
Am I getting that right?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, and you know, what can I say? It's a good story, but it's really surprising.
Right. Now, let's take a moment. And so I want to hear from just before we go to break, from your perspective, when you heard the answer, trust the system, you know, so I guess I'm trying to put myself in Satya's shoes. What he's trying to say, I mean, obviously he doesn't want everybody coming to asking for raises right away. I'm trying to think, what is he trying to say, that maybe Microsoft is going to be good? Let me handle this. I got this. Or what do you think he was trying to say? And what do you think was wrong with his answer?
Okay. So I think that he was genuinely not picking up the difference between a woman wanting advice about asking a raise, because women are well known to not be as willing to ask for a raise as men are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think he was just talking in general about employees would be better off trusting the system. Mm-hmm. And the reason I corrected him was that I really do think, because women ask less often, that's one of the things that actually accounts for them being paid less and being promoted less often. And that's the point I wanted to make. And I don't in any way think he was discriminating against women, but his response was interpreted as discriminating against women.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it was at a conference for women in tech.
For women. Yeah. And you think that he learned, obviously, he did make some changes after that. After the break, I want to talk about some of the persisting issues inside Microsoft. And maybe we can get a little bit into your time on the board. I'm always curious how these corporate boards work. And we've gotten a little bit of insight already. But maybe we could dig a little bit deeper from that than that, if that seems good to you.
Sure.
Okay. So we'll be right back here with Maria Clave on the Big Technology Podcast. Stick around. We'll be back in just a minute or two. And we're back here on the Big Technology Podcast with Maria Clave. She served six years, right, on the board of Microsoft. Almost seven. And the president of Harvey Mudd College in California?
In California. Claremont,
Sunny California. Great. So I wrote about the instance that we talked about in the first part of the podcast in my book, Always Day One. And while I was researching what was going on at Microsoft, I saw that some issues still persisted with the company's treatment of women. Now, the culture, it seems for a long time, has been the loudest guy in the room, often guy, very like kind of software engineer power type of place. And just like, yeah, the men that had sort of been there forever controlled it. So I wondered whether it had solved some of the issues that it had with treatment of women in the workplace. And then I saw there was a letter. This is a report from 2019 in Wired that had gone around Microsoft, where women inside the company had complained about their treatment. So I'm going to see if I can read a little bit from the story. So the story said, one woman wrote she had been asked to sit on someone's lap twice during a business meeting where HR and other executives were present and no one objected. The HR leader was later promoted while the woman was reprimanded for not following policy. God, that's unbelievable to read. And then here's another one. One woman mentioned that during a roundtable with women for Xbox, nearly all the women had said they had been called the B word at work. So Satya obviously, you know, said he's making an attempt to improve. I have no doubt that he had an earnest attempt to do it. Are you surprised? I mean, yeah, are you surprised to see some of these issues persist at Microsoft? What's your reaction upon hearing some of this stuff?
Well, I think the first thing would say it's a very big company.
Yeah.
And, you know, over
hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Employees. And so my sense is that from talking to women at Microsoft is that things got much better in some parts of Microsoft and not so much in other parts.
Okay.
Which is, and a big part of this is culture. So,
right.
I would say the Microsoft culture really was very much about the loudest person in the room. And whether you're a male or female, you were, the only way you were going to be taken seriously is if you knew how to argue your points effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But when women argue their points effectively, they're much more likely to be called the B word.
Hmm.
And when men argue their points effectively, they're just being assertive.
Hmm.
But women are being aggressive and bitchy. So, And, you know, I'll never forget, I worked at IBM Research for 8 years after starting in 1980. And when I started working at the Microsoft, the IBM Research Lab in San Jose, California, one of the things I did early on at a lunch with the director of the lab was to say that I thought we should start a lecture series that was open to all lab members. And he basically said, there's no point in doing that. Most researchers don't know how to give a talk that other people in other disciplines could understand. And I argued with him. And that got me the nickname of Bitch on Wheels.
Oh, my God.
And of course, I started a lecture series. It was called the Leonardo da Vinci Lecture Series. And it was a success, et cetera. I mean, I wasn't going to stop just because the director thought it was a bad idea. But, you know, so I think the thing is that if you're at a place like Microsoft, where in order to have to be heard, you have to be really very assertive about your ideas. And you probably have to be persistent and say it more than once, because the first and second and third time you say it may not actually register. Of course you get labeled a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just, there's sort of no way around that. And the fact that, you know, if I think about Xbox, so I remember, I led a research project started in 1992 on gender differences and how children play with video games. And I had an interview with the person in charge of Nintendo for the US as I was starting this work. And he just told me, girls will never play video games. They don't like video games. We don't even think about them when we're thinking about producing things for Nintendo. And I was sort of like, that's ridiculous. Hmm. But, you know, there's so much bias about video games and, you know, how women are represented in games, you know,
yes.
Large breasts. I mean, Cortana was, who's the Siri-like individual for Microsoft, is named after a character in, you know, a standard video game with princes and thrones and violent action and so on. I could hardly be surprised at all that every woman in that round table, at some point, somebody would have called her a bitch.
Did you ever bring up the Cortana thing at the board meeting?
I did.
How did they react?
It was just, you know, waved away. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I'm going, why would you want to name it after a character who is very heavily sexualized and that, you know, no woman in tech would want to be compared with?
And they weren't hearing it.
Definitely not.
How much? So you mentioned Bill Gates. Let's talk about him for a moment. How much of this do you think was due to the culture that he developed at Microsoft? You think about the big tech companies, a lot of them are just kind of in the mold of their founders. Amazon is very Jeff Bezos. Facebook is a Zuckerberg type of place. Microsoft, how much of this is sort of the culture?
It's hugely from, you know, I would say Bill, Paul Allen, and Steve Ballmer as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think one of the things about somebody like Bill Gates is he literally thinks he's one of the smartest people in the universe. And mm-hmm. he's a highly intelligent and successful person, but he's definitely not one of the smartest people I've met. Partly because he doesn't know what he doesn't know. I mean, mm-hmm. he really thinks he can go talk to somebody for a couple of hours and he will understand deep things. And one of my favorite argument was Bill was when he told me that there was no real mathematical research being done in the last 20 years, that there were no real discoveries. And I happen to be, first of all, I'm a research mathematician, but I'm also on the board of the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute at Berkeley, which is the top place in the world for convening mathematicians from around the world to basically work on the hottest topics. And I'm telling him about some of the recent discoveries in the last 20 years and, you know, how big this is and et cetera. And he's like, no, I know. Mm-hmm. I talked to somebody who really knew the field and they told me there were no recent discoveries. And I'm saying, you're talking to somebody who really knows the field and she's telling you that there are. And, you know, just sort of crazy.
Yeah. And it's so going back to the way I started the segment, Satya can come in and he's changed the culture for sure, but he had his work cut out for him.
Oh, for sure.
There was a lot to change. And I've always thought that the strategy of Microsoft, you know, he shifted it from the desktop operating system to cloud and mobile. That was one thing. The culture was always the toughest thing for him to change. And it takes time.
I think, so there's a saying that culture eats strategy for lunch every day. Mm-hmm. I think culture, changing culture is the hardest thing to change in any organization and does take a lot of time. But I think he's made a lot of progress.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I think you're right. Like it's a big company. It's never going to be 100% right away. But from what I've heard from the people I've spoke with inside the company, it is very different from, you know, the days of Gates and Ballmer, where people seem to be listened to in some way. And it's funny, like Gates and Ballmer era doesn't seem like people really listen to. And that's kind of, I think, why the strategy went off the rails. And your experience, you know, is sort of indicative of what happened there.
Yeah. I think it really, they needed a reset. I think Satya was a fantastic mm-hmm. choice. Now, to be fair to Bill Gates, who pushed hardest to pick Satya? It was Bill.
It was Bill. Okay.
It was Bill. And mm-hmm. I think he was totally right.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good choice. Do you have any other fun Bill Gates stories? Now that we're on a roll, I figured, okay, let's see if there's any more.
Well, you know, I guess one of the things I want to point out is that he mm-hmm. was the person who started the Giving Pledge. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't want in any way to say that Bill has not done good things with his life. He certainly has done some very good things with his life. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, much of the global health progress has come out of the Gates Foundation. And that's something he really pushed. He's pushing very hard on the climate change issue. So, you know, I don't want to say this is somebody who, you know, this is somebody who's done a lot of very good things with his life as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I would say that most of the strange things are just one social interactions with him. And, you know, the fact that he can be very charming and very thoughtful and, you know, completely there and interacting with you. And then the next time you see him, it's like you're a fly on the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's something also he gets credit, I think, for some of the vaccine stuff that.
Yep.
And we talked about this on this show. He really pushed that forward.
Yeah.
And put pressure on a lot of countries to get their act together when it came to the COVID vaccines and look at what it's done for us. So people are complex. But yes. Doesn't mean we should let them off the hook, I guess, if they're going to be jerks, especially about important issues like the ones we've talked about. So I'm just kind of curious, how does someone join a board of a company like Microsoft? And what, and let's end this section on this. Like, how do you join the board of a company like Microsoft? And what is it like participating in something like that?
Well, it was my first public company board. I think you will not be surprised that I was I really wanted to do it. I had noticed that Shirley Tilghman, who's president of Princeton, had joined the Google board. Mm-hmm. And John Hennessy was on the Apple board and the Google board. And I had had a conversation with the board chair at the time at Harvey Mudd and said that I was interested in joining the board of public company. And mm-hmm. he said, well, do you have any companies in mind? And I said, well, my three top choices will actually be probably Google, Microsoft, and Amazon. Google's not going to happen because they already have an academic leader on the board. We actually have two academic leaders on the board. So Amazon and Microsoft would be my first choices. And he sort of laughed and said, you know, it's not like you're aiming high or anything. And
that's the way to do it.
Maybe 2 months after that, I got a phone call from Rick Rashid, who was then head of Microsoft Research and somebody mm-hmm. I have known for a long time. I know a lot of people at Microsoft Research. And he said that they were considering adding an academic leader to the board, and they were interested in somebody who was had done a lot of strategic planning, which is something I have done a lot of, and somebody who's a computer scientist, and if possible, a woman. Well, how many?
Check, check, check.
How many female computer scientists are presidents of higher ed institutions?
One.
So, yeah. And Rick, bless his heart, he said, you're probably not going to be interested in this. And I said, Rick, it's on my to-do list.
Amazing.
And so yeah. The next thing was that I went up to Seattle and had a meeting with Bill Gates for like 45 minutes. And he spent pretty much all of his time asking me about Harvey Mudd and mm-hmm. So on. And then the next thing was that Steve Ballmer came down to visit me at Harvey Mudd and interviewed me. And mm-hmm. then I got elected to the board.
And so when you're, I guess, like you said, you'd gone to some of these trainings, you're told to ask questions. What was it like actually participating in the board? Were they receptive? What type of discussions did you have?
I think it varied a great deal what the particular topic was. And I think it also varied. Like a lot of the board work actually gets done in committee. And one of the committees that I was on, so I was on the compensation committee, but I was also on the antitrust committee, which was formed as part of the antitrust settlement with Microsoft. And basically that was an effort to try to make sure that there was nothing Microsoft was doing that could be considered as, you know, going against the settlement. And then after the 10-year period after the settlement ended, then they reformed it and became the Ethics and Public Policy Committee. And I found those discussions extremely interesting.
Fascinating.
The people from that we were interacting with were interesting, open, respectful. And so I think just a lot of it depended on who was present. And so, mm-hmm. You know, I've already told you that, you know, I have an enormous amount of respect for Satya and Brad Smith. I have a lot of respect for Kathleen Hogan and Amy Hood and, you know, a lot of the senior leadership team at Microsoft. So just different people have a different attitude to actually having a discussion, answering questions, asking questions themselves. And I always felt that, you know, with certain groups of people, people took everything you said very seriously, and you were heavily engaged in with others, that was less the case.
Right. What type of questions would you tackle with the ethics part of your responsibilities?
Well, you know, it's a lot of questions about privacy.
Pertinent.
I mean, obviously really important right now. A lot of questions about, you know, obviously one of the things that the antitrust settlement was about was this, the evidence that Microsoft was putting other competing products out of businesses by including a competing product within the operating system that came for free. And so, you know, Netscape is the obvious example where, you know, it basically lost out
to IE, Internet Explorer.
And of course, Google Chrome has since, you know, basically
crushed,
taken over there. But so a lot of these are sort of, you know, what's an appropriate way to use the influence that Microsoft has? You know, other kinds of things are security issues. So I'll never forget at some point, we were told that Microsoft was moving to two-factor security as a way of really protecting everyone. And, you know, it was something that, you know, was clearly the best in class at the time. And it was a really good thing for Microsoft to do. So, you know, it's those kinds of issues were the kinds of things that got discussed. I think I was really pleased that Microsoft came up with a privacy policy that, you know, I thought was a really good step forward, particularly compared to what, I mean, Apple also has a very strong policy, privacy policy, Google, not so much, Amazon, mm-hmm. not so much. So, you know, these issues, that was one place where one area where I felt Microsoft, partly because of having been through the antitrust case, took some really strong positions on things. So, so it would be, you know, I don't want to imply that there weren't lots of occasions where I felt it was really useful to be on the board and the discussions were really helpful, and it was possible to feel listened to and respected, because there certainly Great. Were many of those.
But I guess on the diversity front, that was where it was a struggle.
Well, it's a struggle with some people.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I'll just say Kathleen Hogan is somebody who has really fought for diversity. Amy Hood is another one. Sasha, yeah. obviously, is somebody who's pushed hard there. So, so I have a funny Bill story. So I had been invited to invite Bill to be a co-host of a retreat at Sunnylands. Sunnylands is the former home of Walter and Lenore Annenberg. And it was going to be, it had been all refurbished and they were going to start doing retreats. And it had been suggested to me by one of the MUD board members that I asked Bill if he would be co-host. And I suggested the topic of increasing the diversity in STEM. And he said, I'm not interested in that.
Bill Gates.
Yes. And so then I said, okay, how about the use of technology in K-12 math education? He said, oh yeah, I would do that. And I mean, yeah. And so that's what we did. And the funny story out of that, and it was a fantastic retreat. And what came out of that was an organization called Ed Reports that reviews math, science, and English language arts curriculum for K-12. It's the initial primary funder was the Gates Foundation, but it's now supported by, in addition to Gates, who's still the largest supporter. It's supported by Hewlett, by Overdeck, by Schusterman. And the curriculum folks at the Gates Foundation think it's the most impactful thing they've ever done in K-12 curriculum. And wow. So much so that they refer to it as a verb. Like if they're looking in the Gates Foundation, if they're looking at something that they want to improve, they say, can we Ed reports it? So I helped found that organization. I've chaired the board since it was founded. And that came out of that retreat. So that was a really good outcome. And so what I would say is there are things Bill's interested in, and there's things he's not so interested in. And when he's interested, then he's a great partner.
He can make real impactful change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have maybe 10 more minutes where we can talk a little bit about antitrust now that you brought it up?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Let's go to break quickly and come back and talk about antitrust. We'll be back right after this. And we're back here for one final segment on the Big Technology Podcast. Thanks for sticking with us. It's already been 50 plus minutes. Thanks, Maria, again for joining us. Let's talk about antitrust, because one of the things, so there are six bills in Congress right now that are targeted at the big technology companies, maybe Microsoft, maybe not, but certainly Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google. There's also a new head of the FTC, Lina Khan, who is going to be very aggressive when it comes to enforcing some of the rules against these companies. And there's a question of, even if it doesn't succeed, can the very nature of the fact that there's going to be regulatory pressure end up hampering these companies' ability to do business? So, Maria, you saw this on the board, you know, serving on the antitrust committee with Microsoft. What sort of burden, and I know there was a settlement, but what sort of burden does this type of activity place on a company that is targeted by it? And this is maybe a little speculative, but I'm curious what you think might happen to the four aforementioned, or even Microsoft, now that the guns are turned on them, so to speak.
Yeah, so I mentioned that I worked for IBM Research early in my career, and IBM had been targeted. In fact, they were never actually charged, as I understand it. But, you know, Bell, Ma Bell, was broken up. And that was enough that IBM was incredibly careful about trying to make sure there was nothing we would do in IBM Research or any other part of the company that could lead to an antitrust suit. And, you know, I was there for the first 8 years of my career, and it had a big impact. I mean, it just the fact that they were so serious about trying to make sure that they were not seen as shutting down competition was very interesting. And I think it did have one of the things that I think results that happened was that Sun was very effective in getting their workstations, their Unix workstations, into academic computer science departments. And
Sun Microsystems.
Yes, Sun Microsystems.
Yeah.
And IBM really didn't push back. I mean, they developed their own Unix workstations, which were not particularly successful. And, you know, I just think it's just interesting. I think that once you think that there's a significant chance that you might be broken up, or might be put under very significant restrictions, it puts a lot of pressure on a company. So that's the first statement. The second thing I would say is, you know, both Microsoft and Google have been hit by fines from the EU over antitrust issues. I think it actually had a more significant impact on Microsoft's behavior than on Google's, because Microsoft had been through the antitrust case in the US.
Right.
So, I mean, I have no idea what is going to happen, but I do expect that the threat of antitrust, given that we have an administration right now that seems pretty serious about it, will have a much more significant impact over the next 3.5-4 years than it has in the past.
How did the specter of antitrust enforcement, the settlement, impact the way that Microsoft did business after? Because there was a view that, oh, Microsoft got away easy. Initially, it was ruled to be broken up, and then it agreed to stay together under certain conditions. So how did that actually manifest itself in Microsoft's day-to-day? And as a corollary to that, do you think it helped increase innovation in the world? Because that's what we're kind of worrying about with these bills targeting big tech, is whether they'll restrain them or help increase innovation. So having been through that with Microsoft, I'm kind of curious where you think that factors.
You know, I almost think that the antitrust suit caused Microsoft to start looking in new directions. And, you know, obviously the move to cloud computing has been a huge plus for Microsoft. And I think one of the things it absolutely had to do was move away from making all of its money by selling operating systems and finding another revenue stream that could be equally and in the end much more lucrative. Mm-hmm. So I think it actually pushed Microsoft to be more innovative.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect, but I mean, obviously, both Apple and Amazon have done phenomenally well during the pandemic.
Yep.
They've got lots and lots of resources. You know, obviously, we're going through the transition of Jeff Bezos leaving and Andrew Jassy taking over. Andrew Jassy, I mean, AWS has been phenomenally successful. So I have lots of confidence that Amazon will also do well. Apple, you know, Tim Cook is a very different leader from Steve Jobs, but Apple has done very well under Tim's leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook is a little bit more complicated because of their role in, you know, disinformation that, you know, definitely played a role in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. But as far as I can tell, they're doing just fine. So
yeah, the business is good. Everybody hates Facebook. The Republicans hate Facebook because they say it censors. The Democrats hate Facebook because it's very good at spreading conservative content and then misinformation stuff that you mentioned. So,
but, you know, I mean,
business is in good shape.
If I look at the people who are getting hired by any of these companies, mm-hmm. they're very talented. They're very competitive. And same for Microsoft. They're all being very successful in hiring people at the early stages of their career, at the middle stage of their career, at the senior stages of their career. They're doing really well. I'm not worried about them lacking innovation in the future.
Yeah. Okay. So it could unlock more innovation. Are you overall optimistic about about where technology is heading in this country, in the U.S., and I guess worldwide, and I guess both in terms of innovation, and let's end on this, in terms of innovation, but also in terms of like the societal issues like we've discussed so far today?
Yeah. So, you know, AI is obviously, it's increasingly having impact on society and having impact in lots of ways that we don't actually know how to predict well. Mm-hmm. And I'm on the advisory committee for the Schwarzman College of Computing at MIT. Mm-hmm. And I've been very impressed with some efforts they are making with an AI policy forum where they're really trying to increase the dialogue between the scientists and the government leaders, not just in the U.S., but, you know, I think we could screw things up really royally. And I think we also could use AI to make things a lot better in many areas like healthcare.
Some amazing developments there.
Yeah.
Sure.
So yeah. I tend to be a pretty optimistic person, but I think the thing that I would say is there's never been a time when diversity is more important in technology. Because, and I don't mean just diversity in terms of gender or race or anything like that, or, you know, poverty or social economic levels or any of those kinds of things. I mean, we need more people who understand AI and also understand, pick your favorite area from humanities and social sciences or from some other area of engineering. I mean, it's just, it's having so much impact on so many aspects of everything that we do. I feel like the most important thing we need to do is to make sure that we can educate people at least at the bachelor's degree level so that everyone can actually, doesn't matter whether you're going to go into biotech or whether you're going to go into English literature or whatever, so that people can actually understand data science, AI, and other aspects of technology, because it's going to happen whether we do this or not. And it's going to happen better if we have more voices at the table.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great, great note to end it on. Thank you so much for your time, Maria. I really appreciate it. You know, as I was working on the book, I think I added you on LinkedIn, and always in the back of my mind, I was like, I wonder if Maria would ever speak with me. And so I'm so glad we had a chance to talk today, and for you to, for the fact that you were so open about your experiences. I'm sure not easy stuff to talk about, but important stuff to bring out into the fore. So thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
My pleasure. All right. Well, I think that will do it for us. I just want to say a quick thanks to Nick Guatney, turning this around super quickly. He's our audio editor, Red Circle, for hosting the podcast and selling the ads. If you've heard some ads you like, that's Red Circle. If you heard some ads you don't like, that's my fault. thanks to all of you for listening. If you made it all the way here, maybe give us a rating. If you enjoyed the podcast, we would appreciate that. And if this is your first time here and you want to subscribe, that would be great. We do this every Wednesday. Conversations with tech insiders or outside agitators, or sometimes people who fall somewhere in the middle. So that's the pitch. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week on Big Technology Podcast.